glass mirror blanks from a German firm. INO engineers then had to figure out how to construct nearly everything else on their own. Zago says, "What surprises me is that the know-how came so fast. They have been working like hell. At every stage, they increase the project's ambition and complexity," Gilmore says. For example, he says, when so-called active control systems, including sensors, actuators, and software that position a primary mirror, first became available for larger telescopes about a decade ago, INO engineers incorporated those into design. What's truly astonishing, Zago says, is a precision vacuum chamber that INO engineers and an Iranian company fashioned to coat the blanks with aluminum, transforming the polished glass into telescope mirrors. When the United Kingdom in 2000 set out to build an aluminizing system for its visible and infrared survey telescope for astronomy, Gilmore says, it took us forever to get right. Khosroshahi hopes to forge partnerships with international teams that might install state-of-the-art instrumentation in INO's four instrument slots. He says, "The door is open for our side, though sanctions and politics could stymie some potential collaborations. In the meantime, Iran's burgeoning astronomy community, just a couple of dozen strong, at the project's outset, but several hundred scientists and students today," Khosroshahi says, "is looking forward to some serious stargazing. We fought with disappointment, darkness, and also with words that could discourage us," says IPM's Maryam Turki, adding, "but in the end, we witnessed this glorious birth."
Aperture. Back to Aperture, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met the hidden victims of America's multi-billion-dollar chemical industry. By offering an excellent wage and a comfortable retirement package, chemical giants Dow Chemical and DuPont factories are welcome wherever they go. For many of the town's residents, a job at Dow Chemical or DuPont marks the beginning of a very glimmering future. Yet, victims like Alice, Kenton, and Rukna have seen the ugly truth behind this prosperity. Don't go away. Here's the rest of our program.
850 children are now registered at Rashida B's center. In 2015, Dow gave $4.5 billion to its shareholders, but not a single cent has been given to the decontamination of Bhopal. For weeks, we tried to reach the communications department at Dow to get an interview, without success.
The water that people drink. What's going to answer those questions? It's really important.
I'm not aware of who that is right off the top of my head. We have 50,000 employees, so I'll have to do some research.
Dow never called us back, so we decided to go to the company's General Assembly in Midland, in the U.S., to ask our questions. A few days later, we finally received an email from Dow. The company laments, "Bhopal was a terrible tragedy that we will never forget." But they relieved themselves of all responsibility, stating that, "We acquired Union Carbide more than 16 years after the catastrophe of 1984.
Dow continues to address global issues through human solutions. Issues like clean water, as important as life itself. Dow is working to make water safe and readily available to people all over the globe. The human element. Nothing is more fundamental. Nothing more elemental.
In Dow's wake, countless victims and human tragedies pile up without any damage to the company's profits. In December 2015, Dow announced the biggest financial operation in its history. A merger of $130 billion with another American chemical giant, DuPont. A match made in heaven.
You and DuPont. There's a lot of good chemistry between us.
DuPont made its fortune with dynamite.
Dynamite!
Nylon. And Teflon. The magical material that prevents food from sticking to pans. However, behind the success of Teflon, DuPont hides a dark secret.
I just can't believe at DuPont, the money means more than people.
There's people dying because of what they've done.
DuPont knew years ago what they were doing.
At best, it's despicable. And at the worst, it's criminal.
At the heart of this drama is one city, Parkersburg. Lost in the eastern U.S. The city was built around the DuPont factory. Suzanne Bailey came here in 1978 to work on the Teflon production lines.
I went to work in May the 8th, 1978. That was my glorious day. Right there. They took our pictures.
It's you?
That's me. Without gray hair.
In the middle?
Yep. You know, I was so happy.
You're smiling.
I was. That was the elite job. I mean, everybody wanted to go there because for the money, for the benefits, and everything like that. It was secure.
The chemical industry is a growing one, growing by leaps and bounds.
I mean, you could just mention the DuPont name and doors swung open. It was like princes coming through the door, you know?
Yes, in such an environment, you can look to a bright future with confidence and optimism.
Were you happy, so?
I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled to death.
A few months after starting her job at DuPont, Suzanne Bailey became pregnant. In January of 1981, she gives birth to little Bucky.
When he was born, it was very traumatic. They didn't know what to do with him. They'd never seen anything like it. I could not figure out what happened. He had half a nostril, half a nose. The eye is a keyhole pupil. I didn't know what to do. I was afraid he was going to die in my arms. I had no idea what was wrong.
Bucky survived. He is now 35 years old. But his childhood was spent between his home and the hospital.
I had 30 surgeries in a span of, 6 to 7 years. Where they took rib cartilage to form my nose. I have a metal plate here. They stretched my forehead out so that they could use that skin and bring it down and mold my nose here. I still only have one nostril, functioning nostril.
We had to put the hockey mask on him and the guards because he wasn't allowed to touch his face.
For how long?
He had to wear those for, I would say, 3 months, 4 months.
Time.
Yeah, the only way that he got to take him off was just to eat.
How is it as a kid to grow up and to have, you know, so many surgeries? And I mean, it's pretty intense, you know.
Walking out in public and going into a store or a restaurant, and as soon as you enter, all the eyes are on you. And school, when you go in and you're trying to make new friends, all they see is you're different.
After her maternity leave, Suzanne Bailey began to suspect her job as the cause of Bucky's deformities. A mysterious source tips her off to one molecule in particular, C8, the molecule in Teflon that stops food from sticking to pans.
When I went back to work the first day, I went to the locker and I found the paper laying there. I picked it up and I began reading about it. It was talking about how the rats were fed the C8 and what deformities that it had around their face. And I thought, that sounds just like Bucky.
It was very similar to what Bucky had.
Absolutely. Very similar, almost identical to what he had. That's why I knew that there was something wrong. That's why I connect.
The scientific study Suzanne Bailey found had been conducted by a subcontractor of DuPont. It studied baby rats whose mothers were exposed to C8. They developed abnormal eye lenses.
I immediately walked out that door, went down to medical, and I said, is this what's wrong with my baby? Oh, no, no, no. Nothing on this planet will hurt you. That was the motto. That's what they always say.
Yeah.
Nothing here will hurt you.
But in the meantime, DuPont was secretly investigating the pregnant women working in their factory. 2 out of 7 children born to the factory workers had facial deformities like Bucky. Shortly after, DuPont decided to transfer Suzanne Bailey and her colleagues to other departments. At the time, Kenton Wamsley also worked in the manufacturing department of Teflon. He remembers the discussion he had with his manager.
He said, Ken, we sent all the women home out of Teflon, all of them. He said, oh, don't worry. It won't hurt the men, just the women. We feel that it can cause trouble. So I thought, won't hurt me.
Kenton Wamsley was a lab technician. He handled C8 for 30 years.
Breathe the fumes from them, all the samples, we breathe. But we just, you know, at the time, we thought DuPont would take care of us. And so I just did my jobs for years and years, you know. And we didn't realize it. Our health was an issue then. Surgeon diagnosed me as having cancer. It had to take all my rectum, part of my colon.
They're giving you that for every 5 years.
Now Kenton Wamsley has to live with an ostotomy bag attached to his stomach. He changes it day and night. At the factory, he worked in a team with 3 other technicians.
My buddies, people I really love, seen them every day, cared about them. Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. They didn't even see retirement. None of them.
Wamsley and his colleagues were never warned about the risks of C8. However, we procured a confidential document from DuPont. It's dated 1982, 34 years ago. In it, Mr. Rector at the time expresses concern about the consequences of C8 retained in the blood of employees. He specifically recommends that practical steps be taken to reduce this exposure.
All employees, not just Teflon area workers, are exposed. So rather than to do anything, they just wrote it out. I've never seen a letter like that. I'm mad. You can see why. We could have prevented a lot of lies if they would have told us there's a problem. Why'd they cover it up? Why'd they lie? Why didn't they have us protected? Too costly?
We track down Bruce Carr, DuPont's former medical director. He is now enjoying a peaceful retirement by the ocean, far from Parkersburg.
I have a document of 1982 showing that you were aware that C8 was toxic for workers. Why have you not told them the truth at that time?
They were all told the truth. They were told everything we knew at the time.
Actually, no. I have interviewed some employees and they were not aware of anything.
We told employees everything we knew as soon as we knew it. You go back to 1982, you're trying to do reconstruction history, and you can't do that.
Why have you not protected your employees?
Il a raccroché.
DuPont would not only put their employees in danger. Once again, tens of thousands of people would be affected. They live up to 70 kilometers away from the factory. One man would discover this, a bit by accident. Joe Kiger. On October 31st, 2000, he receives a letter from the municipality concerning the quality of the tap water. It mentions C8.
I was sitting in my courtyard, and the wife was watering the flowers, and we got our water bill in the mail, and with that bill came a letter. It's like you get form letters all the time. So you look and say, oh, okay, bang, and you put it over and you don't think about it. Next thing you know, you throw it away. And that's basically what this was. It just caught my attention, and I started reading through it, and then the flag started popping up. First of all, what was C8 here, mm-hmm. which is used by DuPont Works? Well, what's DuPont have to do with our water?
Joe Kiger sought clarification on the matter.
I called DuPont to try to find out. So they put me in touch with a guy, a gentleman named Mr. Kennedy. And I said, you know, I'd like to know more about this C8 issue. He just told me it's nothing to worry about. It was just a byproduct of Teflon, and it wasn't anything to worry about. And he was flat out lying to me. I could tell that.
To get to the bottom of it, he takes DuPont to court. After a long legal battle, the judge forces the company to declassify their internal studies on C8. Joe Kiger discovers the truth behind the factory at Parkersburg. For decades, they've been dumping C8 waste into the river. To make things worse, DuPont has known since 1984 that the molecule spread into the region's tap water. The company found astronomical levels in public taps, up to 50 times the limit of toxicity, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
That was 1984, and we didn't come out till 2000.
So 16 years.
Yeah, before we even hit them up about it. And they chose, as you see right here, they chose not to do anything about it. And they knew what was coming with the liabilities if they got caught. They were trying to slide under the radar. People trusted DuPont for so long. They have done nothing but lie for years to people about what this stuff's all about. There's sick people out here because of what they've done. There's people dying because of what they've done.
During all these years, more than 70,000 people have been drinking contaminated water. In 2011, both scientific research and the U.S. justice system established that C8 could cause six diseases: thyroid disorder, high cholesterol, ulcerative colitis, high blood pressure, kidney cancer, or testicular cancer. Today, 3,500 people in the Parkersburg region are ill. They've all filed complaints against DuPont. This is the case for Earl and Gwen Botkin.
I've had ulcerative colitis for about 17 years, and it's about killed me a couple of times. I still have thyroid problem, and I have high cholesterol. And those are all associated with C8.
Today, Earl Botkin doesn't have a colon anymore. He, too, is living with an ostotomy bag.
So all of a sudden, you don't function normally, but you have your bowel movement on your side. And that's what I live with until I die. And there's not any hope of that's going to change. It controls where I go, what I do, and what I eat. It just controls a lot of things in my life. But Anyway, I lived through that.
A document reveals that all of these victims could have been spared. On May 22, 1984, a meeting took place at the DuPont headquarters. The directors are worried about the consequences for the inhabitants. They plan to eliminate all C8 emissions.
I wanted to show you these sentences here.
But finally, no measures are taken. Their argument, it's not economically attractive.
That was in what year?
84. That's before we were married. That's a long time ago. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Long, long time ago.
That's crazy. That's what makes it so bad, you know, that they had evidence all along and just disregarded it and kept doing what they were doing.
It was company greed that caused this whole situation. They knew what they were doing to us, and they continued to do it before money. That's the only reason they continued to do it.
DuPont refuses to collectively compensate the 3,500 sick people. They prefer to study the cases one by one. As a result, since 2012, only one victim has been able to get a trial. DuPont was sentenced to pay her $1.6 million. The 3,499 remaining victims, like Earl Botkin, are still waiting. At the current pace of the trials, the last one would take place in 100 years.
Do you still trust and you're still confident that you will get a trial at some point?
Oh.
He lives long enough.
If I live to be 150, I'm right. It's kinda, there will be a trial someday. But the chances of me living long enough to ever see that are probably slim to none. But we're just another document, another number of cases to be tried. DuPont has made billions of dollars. I think they should stand up to what they've done and make it right with the people they've made sick.
DuPont refused all of our requests for an interview, so we drove to their headquarters in Delaware on the East Coast to convince them to answer our questions. At the other end of the line, we reach the head of media relations, Daniel Turner.
We are doing a documentary piece. The best way is, you know, we meet and to make a proper interview, you know, at some point. But first, let's meet. You know, I'm just here.
We'll respectfully decline the on-camera interview. I will provide you with a statement.
You know, there is like an incredible amount of documents showing that you have known at DuPont for the past 30 years that C8 was toxic. And you know that you were poisoning your employees at the Washington Works plant and the Parkersburg citizen. Why are you not recognizing the fact that you have deliberately poisoned thousands of persons?
Okay, so are those the questions you're asking?
Yeah, this is my questions.
Okay, I'll be happy to provide with our statement.
Today, we are in 2016. There are still 3,500 persons with severe disease that are waiting to just have the right to get a trial. I mean, for how long are you going to deny your responsibility? Are you waiting that they all die?
So, we will provide you with a statement for your piece.
Nothing else? No?
Like I said, we will provide you with a statement. Thanks so much. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
We did receive a press release from DuPont, but without a single word for the victims. They claim to have studied C8 carefully for decades and affirm to have always acted responsibly. In 2015, DuPont finally stopped using C8. The company was also ordered by the courts to clean up the region. But how many generations are still to experience the after effects of this contamination? In the chemical world, history inexorably tends to repeat itself. It takes decades to reveal the truth. and just as many years for the multinationals to be prosecuted. In their laboratories, new toxic molecules are constantly being developed. But in 10, 20, 30, or 40 years, who knows how many new victims will be poisoned?
Merged together, Dow Chemical and DuPont create the world's largest chemical company in terms of sales. Yet, the victims' testimonies, those whose lives have been poisoned, will forever cast a shadow over this industry as they fight in the hope that someday their culprits will be brought to justice. And that's it for this week, everyone. Join us next time for another documentary. It's goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
A German think tank has warned that Europe's largest economy will face a recession next year, and a reduction in Russian energy supply will increase inflationary problems in Germany. The Institute of Economic Research, a German think tank, warned that the German economy is expected to shrink by 0.3% in 2023. The cut in the supply of gas from Russia in the summer and the significant increase in the price of this product harmed the recovery of Germany's economy after the coronavirus pandemic. Also, the real income of German households and purchasing power in this country will be greatly reduced. We have taken a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian writes, last week, the Munich-based Institute of Economic Research slashed its prognosis for German economic growth, declaring the country is heading into a winter recession. It forecasts Europe's largest economy would shrink by 0.3% in 2023, after growing by just 1.6% this year. Inflation is forecast to hit 8.1% this year, and 9.3% in 2023. Timo Wolmershauser, the Institute of Economic Research's head of forecasts, said the cuts to gas supplies from Russia this summer and the drastic price increases they triggered are wreaking havoc on Germany's economic recovery following the coronavirus pandemic. Timo Wolmershauser added, he did not expect a return to normal until 2024, when 1.8% economic growth and 2.4% inflation could be expected. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz is travelling to the Persian Gulf in the coming days to secure supplies of liquefied natural gas, LNG, from United Arab Emirates, as Russia chokes off its gas supply to Germany. A recent survey has shown consumer confidence to be at its lowest level since the founding of the Federal Republic of Germany in 1949. Faced with higher energy bills, German households are rethinking spending, from holidays to household purchases and meals out. Businesses are doing the same, avoiding new investments and instead holding crisis meetings about how low they can reduce heating in factories and offices. Increasing number of companies are switching their workers into Kurzarbeit, short-time working mode, which was first introduced in the 1920s in response to the economic crisis in the Weimar Republic, and later utilized to considerable effect during the global financial crisis. This willingness to cling on to workers is seen as crucial if Germany stands a chance of emerging from the current crisis. But increasingly, the question is being asked, how long will it be able to afford to do so? The website Politico explains more about the same story. Germany's Bundesbank said in its monthly report on Monday, 19th of September, that Germany is heading into recession as inflation is set to top the 10% mark. The report said there are mounting signs of a recession in the German economy in the sense of a clear, broad-based and prolonged decline in economic output. The central bank projects a moderate contraction for the current quarter and more pronounced declines in activity in the final quarter of this year and the first quarter of next year. The Bundesbank, the German central bank, said high inflation and uncertainty with regard to energy supply and its cost affect not only the gas and electricity intensive industry and its export business and investments, but also private consumption and the service providers dependent on it. The Bundesbank did not offer any specific numbers and cautioned that the outlook for the Eurozone's largest economy remains shrouded in uncertainty. The industry-heavy German economy is very reliant on Russian gas, making it particularly vulnerable to the fallout from the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. At the same time, the report said inflation is seen accelerating further and coming in at double digits in the coming months. The British newspaper The Financial Times sheds more light on the same issue. Investors are now more pessimistic about the German economy than they have been at any time since the Eurozone debt crisis more than a decade ago, worrying that a sharp fall in Russian natural gas supplies and soaring energy prices will plunge the country into recession. The ZEW Institute's gauge of investor expectations about Europe's largest economy has sunk to its lowest level since 2011, dropping from -53.8 to -55.3, underlining the deepening gloom about the economic fallout from Russia's special operation in Ukraine. Economists have slashed their estimates for economic growth in Germany and the wider Eurozone this year, while raising their inflation forecasts and warning that an end to Russia energy supplies would force Berlin to ration gas supplies for heavy industrial users. According to the European Energy Exchange, German baseload power for delivery next year, the benchmark European price, rose over 5% to a record €502 per megawatt hour. This is 6 times higher than the price a year ago, driven upwards by the sharply higher cost of gas used to generate electricity and a prolonged European heat wave that has disrupted generating capacity in Europe. According to data from Eurostat, the European Commission Statistics Bureau, the surging price of energy has driven up the cost of imports for Germany and other Eurozone countries, sending the bloc's trade deficit up to 24.6 billion euros in June, compared with a surplus of 17.2 billion euros for the same month a year earlier. The value of exports from the bloc rose 20.1% in June from a year ago, but imports were up 43.5%. Michael Schroeder, a researcher at the ZEW, said the still high increase in consumer prices and the expected additional costs for heating and electricity are currently having a particularly negative impact on the prospects for the consumer-related sectors of the German economy. Michael Schroeder said investor sentiment also worsened due to the expected tightening of financing conditions after the European Central Bank, the ECB, raised its deposit rate by 0.5 percentage points to zero in response to record levels of Eurozone inflation. Karsten Brzeski, head of the macro research at Dutch Bank ING, said the German economy was quickly approaching a perfect storm caused by high inflation, possible energy supply disruptions, and ongoing supply frictions.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. Today we will look at a few more verses on the topic of faith. There are a few points we must consider. Firstly, faith is one of the foremost qualities of God's prophets and the true believers who follow them. They have faith in their own message. This is the difference between divine leaders and the political leaders of the world today. A divine leader, as someone who follows this path, by whatever he says, by every step he takes, by the path that he follows, with all of his being, is a sincere believer. On the other hand, the world's political leaders might sometimes say nice things and give moving speeches, but this does not necessarily mean that they necessarily believe in what they say to even the slightest degree. There is a story about the leaders of one of the communist nations of the Eastern Bloc, who professed atheism and utterly rejected any culture or philosophy that was not based on materialism. This story takes place shortly after the Indian independence. In order to win the hearts of the massed millions of Indians who have just won their independence, these leaders visit India.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There, the people of India were amazed to see that the leaders of this communist nation had tilaka marks on their foreheads. Tilak was one of the leaders of the Indian independence movement, as well as a Hindu religious scholar. He was one of the greatest leaders of the Hindu religion, and both a leader and a pioneer of the independence movement for a period of time. It is worth me taking some time to mention this to you, even though it is not directly relevant to our present discussion, because it is good to know about such things. From beginning to end, the Indian independence struggle lasted 90 years, and from the beginning to end, its most important leaders were all men of religion, whether Muslim or Hindu. Some of the most important Muslim leaders were Maulana Shah Mahmud Dehlawi, Maulana Mahmud Al-Hasan, Maulana Abul Kalam Azad, Maulana Muhammad Ali, and Maulana Shaukat Ali. In any case, when these communist leaders, who espoused atheism and materialism, went to India, in order to win people over to their cause, they put the tilak mark on their heads. In other words, they wanted to say, yes, us too, we believe the same as you. This, even though their own words and beliefs contradicted the statement. Those political leaders who are removed from spiritual, religious, or divine responsibilities are like this. But the prophets of Allah believed in whatever they spoke with the totality of their being.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence's aides told the committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol that former President Donald Trump pressured his vice president to reverse his defeat in the 2020 election. According to the panel's report, Trump pressured and even threatened Mike Pence, despite being repeatedly told that it was illegal to do so. Trump has repeatedly denied the accusations against him and has continued to repeat his claims of widespread fraud in the U.S. elections. Former U.S. President and his supporters, including many Republican members of Congress, described the January 6th committee as a political plot. We take a look at this issue and some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website of the British newspaper The Daily Mail has written, a new book reveals former President Donald Trump repeatedly assured aides after he lost the 2020 presidential election that he would remain in the White House and not cede power to Joe Biden. According to a forthcoming book by New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman, Trump told one aide, I'm just not going to leave the White House. Maggie Haberman wrote, Trump seemed to realize he had lost to Biden immediately after the election, but his mood later changed. He told another aide, we're never leaving. How can you leave when you won an election? The book, Confidence Man, The Making of Donald Trump and the Breaking of America, is being released on 4th of October. The new revelation sheds more light on the chaotic aftermath of the 2020 election, which was marked by Donald Trump's refusal to cede power to Joe Biden and his efforts to overturn the election results. Trump began expressing his intention not to leave the White House in January of 2021 as incoming President Joe Biden was getting ready to take over. During a conversation with Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, Trump asked, "Why should I leave if they stole it from me?" In line with his efforts to overturn the election, Trump had called on his supporters to march on the Capitol and disrupt the certification of Joe Biden's electoral victory, which led to the 6th of January 2021 riot and attack on the U.S. Capitol. Maggie Haberman writes in her book, "Trump's pledge that he would not depart the White House had no historical precedent, and his declaration left advisers wondering what he might do next. The former president, however, did not make his intentions public. When asked by a reporter at the time whether he would be willing to leave the White House if Biden had won the electoral vote, Trump responded by saying, "Certainly I will, and you know that I will." However, he was still insisting that the election had been stolen from him through massive electoral fraud. The New York Times covers the same story, but from a different angle. The U.S. Justice Department has issued about 40 subpoenas over the past week, seeking information about efforts by Donald Trump and his allies to overturn the 2020 election. Citing people familiar with the situation, the New York Times said Boris Epstein, a longtime Trump advisor, and Mike Roman, a campaign strategist for Donald Trump, had their cell phones seized recently as evidence. According to the New York Times, Dan Scavino, Donald Trump's former social media director, was also among those who were subpoenaed, which said the group included low-level aides as well as senior advisors. An attorney for Dan Scavino did not immediately respond to a request for comment from the Reuters news agency, while Reuters was unable to contact Roman and Boris Epstein. The subpoenas seek information on a failed bid by the former president and his allies to overturn the results of the 2020 election by submitting alternative states of fake electors. The inquiry is also looking at the assault on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021 by Trump supporters. Some of the subpoenas also check information on Donald Trump's Save America political fundraising group, which the New York Times said was a new line of inquiry by the Justice Department. The British newspaper The Guardian explains more about this issue. Two of Donald Trump's top officials are facing subpoenas for an investigation against him regarding fundraisers following the 2020 elections that aimed to undermine the results of the election. Stephen Miller, once one of Donald Trump's most senior aides, and Brian Jack, his former director of political affairs at the White House, were part of a large group of Trump officials and allies who were subpoenaed by the grand jury recently. The investigation is examining funds related to the Save America Political Action Committee, or Save America PAC, and a plan that would entail sending fake electors to states that had been contested results in the 2020 election. The Save America PAC, which was created by Donald Trump in November of 2020, shortly after the election, is funded entirely by Republicans and is sitting on more than $100 million in funds, up from $31 million in 2020. Stephen Miller, who attracted notoriety during Trump's administration for his alleged links to white supremacists and his staunch anti-immigrant stances, participated in a lengthy testimony earlier this year to the House Select Committee about Trump's role in fanning the flames of the January 6 attack on the Capitol. Before that, in December, Brian Jack also faced a subpoena for his role in organizing a January 6 rally that led to the insurrection. Others on the list of the subpoenas issued recently include officials who were involved with the electoral scheme in various degrees, from junior aides to pro-Trump lawyers assisting in planning the scheme, as well as Republican lawmakers who are Donald Trump's allies. While the subpoena doesn't put the individual directly under investigation, it is an action that the Department of Justice can take against an individual in order to try to garner further information in the case. This week's subpoena is only the latest in a long string of allegations against and investigation of the former president. In the most recent episode, a raid in Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago, Florida estate revealed that he was in possession of documents that he took from the White House during his departure in 2021. Documents that even senior Biden aides did not have security access to view. In response, Donald Trump recently chided the FBI and Department of Justice, accusing them of being vicious monsters under the control of the media and radical left scoundrels.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
People from all walks of life rallied in the Gaza Strip following the Friday prayer in solidarity with Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Protesters shouted slogans decrying the Israeli crimes in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank. In recent days, extremist Jewish settlers, backed by Israeli forces, have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli attacks usually increase during Jewish holidays. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the rally, warned the Tel Aviv regime against crossing the red lines at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
Armed resistance is the only choice for Palestinians to fight the occupation. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire by attacking Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds is growing stronger. The Zionists are adding fuel to the fire, and it may only burn them.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to step up their support for Al-Quds until the end of all the Israeli violations in the Holy City. They also reiterated their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds.
We call on all Muslims to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque because it belongs to all Muslims. We call on our brothers and sisters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds to increase armed resistance against the Zionist enemy. The whole world must understand that we are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967, while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state.
We are here today to condemn the continued Israeli attacks against our people in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. The Palestinians are fighting for a just cause, and they will continue to fight until they regain their freedom.
Palestinians maintain that continued Israeli infringements upon Al-Aqsa Mosque will only increase the resistance against the occupation.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds while turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
It's been just a few weeks since the now resigned Prime Minister, Liz Truss, promised low taxes and high growth. Events have moved incredibly fast in Westminster that a new finance minister is now raising taxes and promising public sector cuts. The U-turns and counter-U-turns have come with a cost for the economy and the people. A new study has found that millions of households are skipping meals or struggling to put healthy foods on the table. Inflation is already at more than 10%. Energy and fuel prices are on the rise, putting a squeeze on Britain's finances.
Well, the start of all this is Brexit. Brexit led to Boris and incompetence. It led to falling living standards. It led to Liz Truss and further incompetence. And Britain basically voted to become poorer by leaving the EU. You can blame some of it on money printing at the Bank of England, inflation taking out, you know, and lowering living standards as well. So it's a combination of things.
A combination of things that have toppled two prime ministers in the span of 1 year.
It's been less than 2 months since Boris Johnson gave way to Liz Truss as prime minister, followed by the death of the Queen and a dramatic change in the country's economic outlook. And now, yet another leadership contest that could trigger even more economic and political instability.
And more instability means more people relying on charities, from food banks to keep their stomachs full, and warm rooms where those unable to heat their homes can take refuge in the cold months of winter. The new chancellor has curbed Liz Truss's flagship economic plan of a 2-year cap on energy bills to April next year. And at the end of this month, he's expected to announce a midterm economic policy that could spell out the beginning of another prolonged period of austerity.
Whoever takes over, Boris, Rishi, Mordaunt, who knows? But the outlook continues to be bad because inflation is still out of control. There's not the money or the government finances to give the public sector further wage rises to match that inflation. Strikes will continue. The fiscal position of the country remains dire, partly because we have a smaller economy because of Brexit. So there's no easy solution. There's no easy way out of this. The hole has been dug and it's very deep and very difficult to climb out of.
Paying the price of that, ordinary Britons, as the Conservative Party races to choose its third leader and prime minister in 1 year, urgent help to those in need couldn't come any sooner. Saeed Puriza, London.
EU leaders at a summit in Brussels agreed China is becoming too assertive. It's the same phrase they have been using for years with respect to Russia. Iran was also in their sights. New restrictive measures against Tehran were rubber stamped.
Sanctions have been taken against those who are participating in the repression of peaceful demonstrations. And this, of course, is linked to the support of Russia against Ukraine.
Analysts say the allegations against Iran are spurious and they are being vehemently contested. It's pointed out that the bloc sometimes ignores clear international law violations, even when there's zero ambiguity, for example, those perpetrated by Israel against Palestinians. The US is set to have even greater influence over the EU as the bloc moves to try and isolate Moscow and Beijing. It's suggested that has been Washington's plan all along.
Europe, they are totally dependent on the United States and in energy field and in military field. And that is dependency that doesn't allow them to conduct independent foreign policies.
Sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have driven energy costs to unmanageable levels. A complex package has been agreed in principle by EU leaders to try and lower prices and demand.
There's a lot of work now ahead of us what the energy is concerned, but the roadmap is very clear. And it was good to have this unanimity, this broad support for the roadmap that we have put forward.
Leaders admit the energy package is very complex and will take up to 3 weeks to try and finalise. Will this summit deliver positive results for EU citizens? It's a crucial question for millions of households and businesses, but also a vital political question for the bloc's leaders. Extreme left and extreme right anti-EU parties are waiting in the wings. Ignoring massive corruption findings by their own financial watchdog, EU leaders have agreed to provide €18 billion to the Ukrainian government in 2023. But that's nothing compared to what they will spend on lethal weapons for the country's army. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A draft law aiming to punish anyone caught wearing a full face covering has been proposed